This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 7th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode of the show, we'll be getting the lowdown on a design-minded new magazine that showcases the finest finds from the industry's many trade shows.
I really wanted to recreate that sort of visual overload of all the amazing design that's out there, but then present it in a way that people can sort of spend a bit of time with it and go back to it and linger.
We also head to Toronto, where One Architecture Studio is attempting to capture the zeitgeist of the changing city.
Toronto is a canvas. There's so much opportunity. You know, it's a post-industrial city, and we're developing it piece by piece. You know, it's been keeping us busy and the architecture community quite busy.
All that to come and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on today's show, we crack the spine of a hefty new biannual magazine, which charts its editor's favourite finds from the annual procession of international design trade shows. Fiera magazine was founded last December by blogger Katie Tregeddon and creative director of Mag Culture, Jeremy Leslie. Now, on its second instalment, the title provides a tightly edited record of new and exciting products showcased at fairs throughout the previous 6 months. With this issue, tackling talent from Copenhagen, Stockholm, Frankfurt and Milan. I sat down with the pair to find out about the challenges of transitioning from an online medium to the printed page, and more about their motives for starting the magazine.
I've been writing a blog called Confessions of a Design Geek for about 5 years, and part of my job has always been covering trade shows, and I do that for other blogs and magazines as well. And I felt that the coverage on blogs, you know, it was fantastic. I write a lot of it, so I'm not going to say anything negative about it. But it was sort of fast-paced and exciting, but almost as ephemeral as the shows themselves. So after trade show season had finished, everybody just seemed to go back to their day jobs as if nothing had happened. And I felt there was a place for something a little bit more permanent, a sort of a record of what happened that once back in our day jobs, we could refer back to and sort of take some learnings from, so that having seen all that amazing design, we could then start to sort of use some of that back in our day jobs.
So enter Jeremy Leslie. Obviously, you've got great experience with magazines. And regular Monocle listeners will know you from the Stack, our weekly print industry review. But maybe you could tell me a little bit about how you changed something from a digital medium, a blog, into a physical product. And what were the kind of design considerations you make? I mean, we look here and we see the trim size is a little bit smaller. It's very dense. It's very bookish. But could you tell me how you went about designing something that, you know, went from a digital medium onto the printed page?
Well, I think the key to it, was, as Katie says, is that this is something that's meant to be permanent and long-lasting. Alongside most of the fairs that we're covering, it's a biannual, it's twice a year. So it's meant, the idea is that it'll build up into a kind of long-lasting record. So it is bookish. So from the beginning, the format, the general attitude was to do something which was very content-led and very well signposted and clear and easily used in that sense. So it's very functional. It doesn't have to shout too much. But it's about providing that long-term record. It's a kind of a reference piece rather than a kind of flash-in-the-pan magazine.
And one interesting thing that I've always felt about the printed page, and we at Monocle here feel very strongly, is that magazines give you a real tactile format which people can kind of linger on and look through. Could you tell me a little bit about, under the covers, the pacing of the magazine? So it starts out with a section called Kaleidoscope, which is a beautiful kind of series of product shots from the various fairs that you've covered in this issue. And then it kind of tapers out into interviews about, you know, particular products and whatnot. Could you tell me about how you went about using that kind of pacing, and it followed by essays then, you know, how the kind of flow of the magazine came about?
So the first section, Kaleidoscope, is kind of everything I saw that I thought was cool. And I wanted to really recreate the excitement of design fairs. A lot of people can't get to the design fairs that I'm covering, or if they do get to them, they've only got a day to see the whole thing. And I really wanted to recreate that sort of visual overload of all the amazing design that's out there, but then present it in a way that people can sort of spend a bit of time with it and go back to it and linger. Each of those photos has a reference code that then appears later in the magazine wherever that design is referenced, and at the back links to a designer's directory if they want to get in touch with that designer. The next section, which is the main body of the magazine, we then take some of those designs and explore them in more depth. So this is sort of replicating the conversations I have with designers at design shows. So it's interviews, it's understanding the making process, it's more in-depth features about some of the exhibitions. And then at the back, I think the opinion section is really, really important because that's about offering a bit of analysis, a bit of context, something that makes sense of it all. So rather than it just being this visual overload, actually trying to pull out some of the key themes, some of the macro trends, you know, the what does it all mean section, which I think is a really important thing this magazine delivers that isn't really delivered anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lovely essay in there from our former design editor, Tom Morris, on the kind of soft power value of fairs, which is, you know, a very interesting kind of subject. I'm going to ask you a very unfair question now. From the past 6 months of shows, are there any trends that you're kind of watching or that you can augur for us from putting together the magazine? Or is it, you know, is there trends in the eye of the beholder and, you know, people need to look through for themselves?
No, I mean, there are actually three key trends I pull out in the magazine. I mean, I'm not really interested in what I would call sort of faddy trends. So flamingos are hot right now. I don't think they serve the design industry particularly well. I'm more interested in big sort of socioeconomic shifts. There's a big trend, which we talk about in the magazine, for designers using waste as a resource. So taking things that are being thrown away or byproducts of other industries and turning them into beautiful products that don't look like they're made from waste. Often there's something, you know, beautiful in their own right, which I think is a really interesting sort of area to watch. And it will be interesting to see how that filters down to the high street and to more mainstream designers.
Sure thing. And if we can come back to Jeremy, I mean, you're very well versed in the machinations of the magazine industry. And this is obviously the second issue. Can you tell me a little bit about how people reacted to the first one and how the second one's going down as well?
Well, I think people reacted very positively to the first one. We are very pleased with the general response and coverage we got for it. It sold well. So this time around, we've been able to up the print run. There's two reactions, aren't there? There's the kind of external, the reaction from people that are buying it, people that are in it, all very positive. I think we learned a lot from the first one, and I'm certainly very excited by the second one. It's a step forward again. We learned a lot in terms of the photographic contributions of up their game. I think Katie already mentioned dealing with upcycling and reusing. That kind of thing was very important to us. We didn't really get to that in the first issue, but that's very present here. And there's another part to all this which we haven't mentioned, and it's to do with the pacing, is that there's a lot of photography, obviously, both in terms of portraiture and products, but we're also very keen on illustration. And there's just as in the first issue, which I think we successfully developed a nice structure around some illustration. In this one, we've taken that again, taken the idea of does the world need another chair and given that out to 10 illustrators to offer their contribution on that front. And that kind of builds pace and change into the whole format, and it delivers something that isn't off.
That was Katie Trigeddon, editor of Fiera magazine and the title's creative director, Jeremy Leslie, speaking to me about the launch of their biannual title's second edition. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Next year, British interior designer Kelly Hoppen will celebrate the 40th anniversary of her business, which she started at aged 16 with a renovation of a family friend's kitchen. Over the past four decades, she has designed over 1,000 residences, including yachts, aircrafts and hotels, adorning them with her signature blend of neutral tones and Eastern-influenced design principles. Next year's celebrations will include the publication of a book chronicling her work, as well as a retrospective exhibition. Hoppen was also recently awarded the Master Award at the Bold Luxury Design Summit, which took place in Palm Springs last week. Kelly Hoppen sat down with Tom Morris, our contributing editor, in Los Angeles to discuss the past 40 years, her knack for keeping clients happy, and how there's more to her work than taupe. Tom started by asking her how the design world's perception of interior design has changed since she started out.
40 years ago, people didn't tell people they employed interior designers because they knew what they wanted and they could do it. So it was very much about... This was in England. You were sort of in the background, and it was very much about you just helping people. Whereas in America, a decorator or a designer has always been something that people have used. So when I was working in New York early on, 40 years ago, I could shout and scream about being someone's designer. It was very, very different. I think that the home has become the most important thing in people's lives, and I think that design has become so accessible to anybody at any level now. So it's not something just for the rich and famous. It's like anyone can make their home feel fabulous. And there are so many books and so many archives and so many magazines that people can look at in the same way as they look at fashion. that it's possible. So I think that design is now a given, interior design is given. I've never really understood the difference between a decorator and an interior designer, but that's a whole other thing. And I think that it's part of people's lives today that my designer or my architect is helping me. And I think it's very difficult to create your dream home. It's not easy anymore. There's a lot of pressure. I think certainly in England, you always need an architect because you need to get planning permissions. You can't just sort of do what you want. Being in LA, looking at all the different architecture, it seems like you can do what the hell you want here. It's very weird. But I think that it's a great industry, and I think it's celebrated now, and there are a lot of awards that people are winning, and I think it's very good.
How do you see your role as an interior designer? I mean, you've got your very identifiable design DNA, which I think sort of the world knows over. But how do you see it as sort of actually creating almost a stage set that's actually almost quite neutral for the lives that take place in them to live out in their own way?
Well, I've always been an advocate of that. I think that, you know, as a designer, my role is to create an environment that families that I work for can have their own experiences. And I think there are a lot of designers out there that will want to put their ego into people's homes. I did when I started at 16 and a half. You know, I had a big ego and it fast and furiously disappeared because I realized that actually the joy of designing is to get into someone's head, extract what they want but don't know they really want, and help them mold that and put it together. And the joy of somebody living in a space and constantly ringing you up and saying, God, it's brilliant, thank you, was the biggest prize of all. So very quickly, my whole mindset changed. And I learned that actually, you are doing exactly what you say. You're creating a stage for people to live in. So my neutral design aesthetics came very much from the East, came from me designing very young and finding fabrics that were very utilitarian, that were very inexpensive, and coming up with that East meets West type of look. But the more I designed, the more I just loved taupe and linens, and I still do. I still get excited when I find the most incredible linen, and you know, people will look at them and go, yeah, and the difference is, and I'm like, no, there is a difference. And I like to have a neutral base because I think we're habit forming and we get bored very easily, and I would rather people move furniture and art and accessories with colour, and that the people living in it are the colour, so that you have a movable film set consistently, so that your home can constantly feel new. And it's worked for me and it's worked for clients. But I do use colour, just bits.
We've just discussed this quite interesting, the snagging month, which is the sort of the month after your clients moved into a project, which you deem to be sort of the most important. Why do you think that is, that sort of that final finishing touch period?
Because I think it's more of an emotional thing. I think once you've lived and breathed and had this protection of an interior design company around you for, say, a year and a half, and then suddenly you move in, inevitably there's going to be a period of a month where things have got to be tweaked and the builders have got to finish. And I realise as a client from hell that that moment needs to be addressed immediately. So people sleep the first night and you go there the next morning and go, now that you've slept here the first night, here is the list that we've produced so that you know we're on it and we're here, just because we're not living with you constantly anymore. Because I think you need to almost break away gently. It's like a relationship and you have to kind of let go. And I think I learned from my own experience now doing this amazing house we've just moved into. And it's my company. So it was quite interesting. I think I can make it better for people because I experienced something and I had a bit of anxiety. Like, they've all run away, you know. Maybe that was because it was me.
That was Monocle's contributing editor, Tom Morris, speaking with Kelly Hoppen in Los Angeles last week. Still to come on the show, we revisit London's vast Battersea Power Station development site. Then we head to Toronto to an event that hopes to capture the ever-changing spirit of Canada's largest city.
London's skyline has a new icon, the 31-storey Canaletto Tower, designed by award-winning Dutch architect Ben van Berkel of UN Studio. Canaletto is a beautiful tower of 190 apartments with hotel-like services, a sensational pool, state-of-the-art gym, restaurant, cinema, and a residence club on the 24th floor with a huge terrace overlooking the city. The spacious balconies wrap themselves around the building and offer spectacular views of the city's landmarks. Canaletto London and Section D on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Now we head to the banks of the River Thames here in London to a restoration project that is one of the most discussed in Britain. The Battersea Power Station development is a vast complex of mixed-use but mainly residential buildings housed within and around the walls of Giles Gilbert Scott's 1930s Art Deco icon. And back in May, we spoke to architect Jim Eyre of Wilkinson Eyre, the studio charged with converting the monumental and heavily protected building, to discuss the project's challenges. Now, as part of the London Festival of Architecture, the Battersea Power Station hosted an event entitled Industrial to Post-Industrial. It examined the history of the power station, as well as unveiling the first phase of development, Circus West. Section D's architecturally inclined producer David Pleasant went along to the evening to meet some of the architects and developers involved.
My name's Ian Simpson. I'm senior partner in Simpson Huff & Partners, and I was involved with the design, concept design, design development.
I'm Rachel Huff, senior partner within the practice, and we are lead consultant for the first phase of Battersea Power Station.
If you can kind of wrap it up in a nutshell, your element of this, you know, vast scheme that we're sitting at the edge of, what element were you particularly involved with? Which aspects of it, you know, did you lead with?
We were fortunate enough to be involved with phase one, which is effectively the very large first phase of the primarily residential development that is located to the west of the power station between the rail track and the river. And that was the first phase, and it's now on site, so it's work that's under construction.
You've just given your talk. There were many themes, very focused on the design and the visuals and really how your building will or is looking. Ian, can I start with you? You made an interesting point about no architect can really know what their building will look like. It doesn't matter how much you spend on fancy renderings and models. We're surrounded by some pretty fantastic models here, but you just never know. Maybe tell us, are you getting some clue of the feel? Any surprises already? I mean, it's part of it's gone up. There's something to see already. Any surprises already?
I think the reality is that every single building is a prototype. So it, by its nature, it'll be a one-off. It'll be unique. So the actual reality can never be fully appreciated until it's complete by the fact that there isn't another one of them. We can make visualizations and models and so on, but they're never the real thing. But what excites us, Rachel and I, is that as we're starting to see the building being completed, the concrete frames coming on, the glazing starting to go on, those are the two key architectural components that will describe the effect of the building in a context. We're really excited about it. We think it's going to do what we thought it might do.
I think it's quite important to say, and actually it comes out very strongly in what Ian said, that as architects we carry huge amounts of responsibility for what we're trying to achieve. These buildings are going to be here for, you know, decades to come, and they're huge investments for our clients.
And actually huge buildings. Your building is actually massive. You said it was like the Shard building on its side.
But it's actually with that responsibility comes privilege, and we feel hugely privileged to be in this position and to be able to contribute to our built environment in this way.
Our responsibility isn't just to the client, that is a responsibility, but it's to the place, it's to society, it's to people who will enjoy or not what we've created. So you've got to think about that, and it's getting that balance to us that's really important.
My name is Dave Tuig, and I'm the head of design and placemaking for Battersea Power Station.
We've just heard a presentation from some of the architects of Phase 1. Somebody in the audience asked you to sort of elaborate on why you think various other developers or other people involved, you know, fell away. What might have been the reasons for the controversy, that the endless kind of bad press that we've seen about this project, and you very kind of eloquently or diplomatically explained what might have happened in the past. Can you run through some of those themes?
Yeah, I think there was a whole coming together of different issues. First off, the power station never had a context. You had this stunning, amazing building with 200 acres of what is one of the nicest parks in London, Battersea Park, to the west, but then you had industrial 200 acres on the other side. So you had this floating power station unconnected to London by real transport, i.e. a Northern Line or an E-Tube extension. You know, I think we looked at it and we said, you have got to have major infrastructure, particularly if you're doing what we want to do, which is mixed-use communities. If we had said, you know what, we'll throw up residential, create another dormitory investment-type development, then, you know what, it wouldn't have mattered about the tube, because people would have moved in, you could have sold it. But we wanted offices, we wanted hotels, we wanted culture, we wanted not just the residential. And that needs tube connections in London. And that was therefore the first big decision, and thankfully supported by Wandsworth and driven forward by the government.
When you have been dealing with all the different architects involved, all the different teams and consultants, how have you kind of managed that process? Some people might say that there's a danger that there's a sort of like a tokenistic kind of attitude by a lot of the teams. You know, they want to kind of shout over their neighbour, you know, they want to show off their kind of iconic designs compared to some of the other big names across the street in phase two and so on. How have you tried to kind of step back and kind of moderate those different teams?
Look, I think you make a good point, but there is an amazingly versatile master plan by Raphael Vignoli that then has a very coordinated rollout. And just a very simple example is Ian Simpson's building, wonderful, on the river, and that is very quiet, very peaceful glass. So when you stand on the North Embankment and you look at that famous facade of the power station, Ian's building steps away from that, and it lets the power station be the icon it needs to be. On the other hand, to the south, you get up against a really, you know, hard edge of a railway track and a busy road, and that's where you say, well, do you know what? What's going to make somebody want to live in this part of the site as much as stand in the northern part or live in Ian's building? And that's why we upped it there. We brought in Frankie and we brought in Norman Foster and said, here's the toughest part of the site. You do something special here to make an amazing community in itself. So from our perspective, it's really well coordinated. And I think once people come and it opens over the next year through to 2020, I think people will start to see that it's quite an interesting strategy.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant there, speaking to his namesake David Twigg, Head of Design and Placemaking for the Battersea Power Station Development Company. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett, and next we head to Canada. Toronto is a city in transition where the pace of change is rapid and poses perennial questions for urbanists, architects, and for those who call the city home. For the past 8 years, architects RAW have presented RAW Canvas, an annual event celebrating a corner of the city that finds itself on the cusp of change. This year, the event took place in a former warehouse, once home to a fabled night spot, which will soon be torn down to become part of a new arts complex on the Toronto waterfront. Monocle's bureau chief in the city, Thomas Lewis, met some of the designers and architects behind this year's event to ask what these annual gatherings say about the change taking place in Canada's largest city.
I'm Almira Youssefi, project architect at RAW. Well, RAW, we're a fairly new, young company. This is our 8th year as an office. We believe in having fun with design, and we have a studio culture that celebrates that, and that's what we like to bring forward into our parties. The party speaks a lot about where Toronto is. Toronto is a canvas. There's so much opportunity. You know, it's a post-industrial city, and we're developing it piece by piece, and RAW has a big part in that, and it is rapidly changing, and there's a lot of opportunity, and there's a lot of growth, which is great, and, you know, it's been keeping us busy and the architecture community quite busy. RAW Canvas is our 8th annual event. And last year was a very big year for RAW in terms of art. We had the Luminotherapy in Montreal, we had the Warming Huts in Winnipeg, and we started the Winter Stations in Toronto. We have a site, which is the Daniels Waterfront, which RAW is designing one phase of it.
My name is Carsten Liesenberg. I'm a project architect with RAW Design. The building we're having the party at used to be a warehouse and is still used as office and warehouse space. And so the new development, Daniel's Waterfront City of the Arts, is a two-phase development. The first phase Ra's working on is under construction right now. It's on the site of the former government and Cool House, which I believe everyone went clubbing there once in their life.
I am Karina Okura. I'm a project architect and contract admin at Ra Design. The reasons of the party are basically just to celebrate and to give back to the city the opportunities that it's provided us. And it's been sort of an evolutionary thing. They were never this large. And it's really exciting every year, the challenges that we come up with. We think of a theme, we find the location, and we really roll with it, and it becomes something amazing. And every year, I feel like we challenge ourselves to make it even better than the last year.
I suppose the idea that sort of captured me most is that you transform this space, especially the space this year. And I got a sneak peek, obviously. And the amount of work and the artistry and the craft and stuff is extraordinary. But then this building will be torn down. And there's something sort of magical about that, maybe representative of the, this isn't too broad brush to say, but the transition sort of underway here anyway, that there seems to be lots of sort of gems from the past that are vanishing quite quickly. But, you know, that doesn't always have to be a negative thing, that actually there are moments of joy still to be had, and then they can go. Just articulate a little of that kind of spirit that you were hoping to...
Actually, I think we all know, people in the building industry, how long and grueling the approvals process is in the City of Toronto. So the fact that we get to create an event and be a part of something that is going to be, you know, gone in a little bit and it's going to be erected very quickly is actually really kind of refreshing for us, that it's not political. It's, you know, there's no, you don't have the same like gravity of a real project. So it was actually kind of freed us in terms of getting the artists and planning this event that, you know, it could be something where we just fully celebrate it and not have to worry about the details too much. So I, if anything, just the fact that this is very temporary is quite exciting.
I don't see any challenge. I think it's, I mean, if anything, it's an exciting challenge and it's an amazing opportunity for us.
I think architects look for challenges. It gives a great opportunity to create something. If anything, restrictions really force you to look at things in a new light and be original and innovative. So even when we saw the space for the event, you know, at first glance it was really big, and you know, there was a couple multiple rooms, and there's this whole effort of tying it together, being able to bring people together is kind of what Ra does, I think. Like we do a lot of urban info and we like challenging sites and creating something that's really remarkable from them.
That was Thomas Lewis, Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, at the Ra Canvas event put on by architecture practice Ra. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, of course, and if you missed any of this week's show or of our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud, or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was perfectly produced by David Pleasant and expertly edited by Alex Fun. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries, or questions. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.